Lend me your ears. The Oral Dramaturgies Podcast. The Salon. Conversations about sound.
Hello and welcome. In the Salon today, David Rosner hosts Katharina Rost and Nicholas Steyman for a rich conversation that takes as its starting point Steyman's theatrical productions and ventures into a whole range of reflections on how dramaturgies of speech, sound and music function on the German stage and beyond. David Rosner is professor of theatre and music theatre at the LMU University in Munich. His research interests span experimental music theatre, the musicality of theatrical performance and the creative processes in contemporary theatre music. Katharina Rost wrote her PhD on sound perception and sonic participation and is currently working as a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Bayreuth. Her interests move across theatre and performance, sound and gender studies. Nicholas Steyman started out playing in bands and is now amongst the most critically acclaimed theatre directors of the German-speaking world. He has presented works at the Festival d'Avignon, Berliner Theatertreffen, and at the Ruhr Triennale, amongst others. This conversation was recorded on the 10th of July, 2020.
Welcome. Welcome, Nicholas Steyman. Welcome, Katharina Rost. I'm very excited to have this conversation. We three have never been in the room together, and we're not now because we're on Zoom, but at least we're in the Zoom where it happens. I just wanted to ask both of you, and I will add my bit, to speak a little bit about how that connection of theatre and music and theatre and sound has sort of brought you to where you are now. So a little bit of a biography by means of how does that connection in particular have had an influence on your work and life so far. Shall we start maybe with Katharina actually and then go to Nicholas? Yeah.
Okay, yes, I've written a dissertation on the subject of sounds in theatre and on listening modes. And because I observed or I heard that there are several listening modes in theatre and contemporary theatre, and I was very interested in how this affected a kind of critique on the linear listening in theatre that might be evoked by speaking an important text following a certain dramaturgy of a sense that you want to bring across. And some theatre companies and some theatre directors followed a different way that I found very interesting, in that they tried to break with this linearity of it. They created spaces, they created diffusion, confusion, different kinds of aesthetics that I found interesting. And so it brought me to think about critical moments of it, a critique of the senses or of an order of the senses by bringing them to a disorder. And I found that very interesting, but from the perspective of a theater scholar and from the perspective of a theater recipient.
Thank you. Nicholas, you're on your webpage, the first sentence is that you started off by making music, that you played in a lot of bands and have never given up music entirely, but then you've studied philosophy and directing. How has the music accompanied your journey to become a director and the artistic director of the Zurich Schauspielhaus?
Well, I somehow couldn't get rid of this musical aspect, right, of my interest and also of my talent and my work and my focus. As you mentioned, I started somehow in music, and my first experiences also with stage, also with being on a stage, but also with staging, if you want, was in bands and in being as a singer and guitarist and keyboarder on stages and in clubs and so on. Yeah, then many things came together somehow, and I still try to understand why did I leave this path of just being a musician somehow and wind up this space and instead shifted to this theater space and tried to shift that always back into music. But I don't really have an answer, though. Yeah, maybe I also had interest in language a lot and in words and in writing and in thoughts and so on. And I always was looking for the mixture of the two and the tension between the two. And being married, or not married, but my partner is a musician. She's an opera singer. And so I know this other world also a bit, and I see musicians, and when I'm working in opera and I'm working with orchestras, and so I see what it means to just do music, and I think I wouldn't be satisfied there either. But just doing theater of spoken words also somehow doesn't satisfy me. So I'm always trying to find the mixture of the two.
There are some overlaps with me, although I have not achieved a level of fame as you do. But I started in opera as well, actually. As a 10-year-old, I was in the children's choir at the opera in Stuttgart. And so in some ways, you know, singing, making music and being on a stage was also a natural companionship in my upbringing, as it were. And then I kind of seem to have never been able to decide between, you know, I'm focusing on theater, I'm focusing on music. So the studying in Hildesheim, which I did, was doing both, and lots of projects I did there, I was doing both. And then my PhD was also, it was called Theater as Music. So it was, you know, literally trying to offer a perspective on how certain directors, I spoke about Martala at the time, and about Einar Schlieff, and this is where the English-speaking audience will sort of come in, to Robert Wilson, because he's obviously the most internationally famous of the three. But in all those cases, I was interested in musical qualities, in how they shape their productions and their directions. So that's been a continuum for me, and it continues to this day. But I wanted to pick up on this question. You've sort of spoken about your journey from being a musician on stage and being in bands, and now bringing the bands back into the theater. And one example, I mean, there's many. There's a band in many of your productions. An early-ish example, which I wanted to talk to you about, is Die Räuber, which was sort of very well received as well. And I think did it go to the Theatertreffen? I'm pretty sure it did.
Yes.
So it's one of the Theatertreffen in Berlin is one of the sort of platforms on which each year the 10, what they call the most remarkable productions of the year in German-speaking theaters are being presented in Berlin. And it's a hallmark, as it were, or it's a way of recognizing outstanding work. I think you combine two things. I mean, you could combine many more, but one of the striking things was the choric nature of it, because you made the robbers into a chorus. So it was no longer just a dialogue between the good and the bad son, as it were. Also there was an extended section where there's a band on stage, where the actors transform into band members, etc. We can play a quick clip at this point so that people can get a sense a little bit of that moment. Komm, lass uns heute lustig sein. Stehen, morgen, Huren, Balgen, heiß bei uns die Zeit zu streuen. Angeln wir am Galgen, drum lass uns lustig sein. So tell us a bit about how that sensitivity or that sensibility for rock enters into your work and how you use it.
In this work, it's maybe not too astonishing, because it is an early work of Schiller. It is one of the plays of the Sturm und Drang. How do you call that in English?
Or is there Storm a term for that? Or is it just... I think they actually call it Sturm und Drang as well. Yeah.
So that was like the rock and roll period of German literature. In the late 18th century. So I think I'm not the first person to combine that with rock music. But what was new in this production was that the actors, even when they talked and when they talked without music, acted a bit like a rock band. And you mentioned that I somehow left the dialogue, and I used dialogues as texts, as monologues, and maybe also monologues for four voices. So there were four men in the center of it who played all kinds of characters, many characters at the same time. And in the beginning, we weren't really sure if this would work, because we also wanted to somehow tell the story, and we wanted to talk about the psychology of the characters and so on. And the astonishing thing was that it did work, that all these things happened in the heads of the spectators, and you didn't need a room or a chair or a table to have a naturalist scene, a scenery. I wanted to somehow trust the words. I wanted to use the words to create all these things and give the words back the energy that they might have had in the time when it was written. And this somehow led to a rock and roll manner of talking, and to a very energetic way of talking, very energetic way of performing as well. And so at a certain point, we couldn't avoid the actors become a real band, a real rock band, because it's another thing that's special. These instruments were played by the actors. So I had two musicians that I worked with a lot, Thomas Gersten and Sebastian Vogel, that you also, I think, did research about and made a book with and so on. And they always in my productions are on stage as live musicians. And in this case, I really had very gifted actors. Felix Knopp, who is like me and like you, maybe someone who couldn't decide between becoming a musician and becoming an actor. And so he somehow is both. And he's a very good guitar player. And as you could hear, he's also a good singer. And Alexander Simon is on drums, and he's really a very good drummer. And so these four made a very good band. The other two actors who couldn't play instruments, you could hear them scream in the background. So they were continuing performing the text in this energetic and direct rock and roll like way. So it was more than just turning Schiller text into a rock and roll song. Somehow this came out of the work.
Can I jump in? And I would like to ask you, if there's a difference for you between speaking and singing, or if there's maybe not such a strict boundary, or what you think are the effects of it?
I like the idea that there's not such a strict boundary. I don't know if in practice it always works, because singing definitely is another way, you know, of expressing yourself than just talking without melody and without music. But I like the idea, and I also like to state in my work that even spoken texts for me is like music, and I like to treat them like music. And this way of thinking helps a lot while creating, because I always can come back to musical systematics or musical measures when I have to make decisions, because I'm considered a lot of being a political director and someone who likes to think and is maybe not intellectual, but likes to deal with intellectual topics and with very complicated texts, with texts that nobody else dares to stage and so on. And that is true, but I don't want to do it in an intellectual way. And what really helps me is to think of spoken text as music, because mm-hmm. then you can be more of a composer or a songwriter than of a thinker, or, you know, someone mm-hmm. who just has to do things in a rational way.
Yeah. I ask because, not because the actors are also singing, but because of what you just said. I had the impression that the actors in your works often are talking in a way that is very musical, that is musically transformed or mm-hmm. informed. And I think it's very interesting that often the texts are quite political or have a strong message, but also then because they are being said in a certain way, they get a certain strong aesthetics too, strong artistic way of being said, and they have effective impacts that might compete a little bit, maybe enhance, maybe also disturb the intellectual message that is given in the text. There's a field of tension for me between the effect of what is being said, affection, and the content or the message. And that is very interesting, I think, when you use this.
That's great. I very much like the way that you describe it, because that's pretty much what I'm aiming at. Having this tension between a very rational system, which is language, and a very irrational system, which is music. And both have a systematic, and both have rules. And to mix these rules make it possible, for instance, to think things that are not thinkable and to feel things that are maybe more than just feeling in a sentimental way. And so this overlapping of the two systems I experience as being very enriching. And so I very much like that you seem to have received it in exactly that way.
mm-hmm.
I wonder how that translates into the rehearsal room, because it's a few years now, but I've written another book about musicality in theatre, and I've looked at a lot of different aspects, but one was sort of the notion that the director should be like a conductor, you know, so that mm-hmm. idea, I think Meyerhold actually says, you know, if you want to direct, you have to study music. You know, he almost, mm-hmm. his program for educating people to become actors or directors would have been training them in the violin and things like that. So because there mm-hmm. was this very strong notion that it needs all that kind of musical sense of form of, and he rehearsed as far as I could find out with a pianist in the room who would basically suggest like a sonic subtext to actors and saying, mm-hmm. you know, you should walk like, you know, this thing by Chopin, or you should, you know, so to incorporate certain musical qualities in their speech, in their movement, etc. I'd be just interested for you to elaborate a little bit on, you know, with those two hats, that the more, this is a heavy text, we need to really understand what it means. We have to get to the bottom of what the politics of this text are, what it means to us today. You're very much a director who, when you do the classics, as it were, which you also do as well as doing new work, sort of world premieres of work, you always tease them into this century and kind of really make them speak to us now. Mm-hmm. So there's that level. And then as you were hinting at that, saying you bring a sort of musical sensibility in the room where certain decisions are probably made not on a psychological basis or on a narrative basis, but on a basis, I think Thomas and Sebastian, you musicians, use the lovely term, the energy logic. You know, there's a certain logic of energy.
Yeah, that's an important term we often use while rehearsing. Yeah. Nobody really knows what it means, but somehow everyone does, yes. Mm-hmm.
Which is always a good term when everyone agrees without having to define it. But mm-hmm. I mean, mm-hmm. on a practical, I mean, some directors, if you learn the craft of directing, there's a lot of creating characters and psychologies and motivations and subtexts and so forth. And here you ask people to make music and scream. Mm-hmm. How does that impact your rehearsal room?
I always have a piano there and next to my place where I'm sitting and where I'm directing. And I'm pretty much directing with making music. With a piano, with a keyboard, with whatever is there. And then often I have live musicians on stage responding me, so we easily can switch into a session. And then the actors, with their skills and their means of language and of psychology and characters and all these things, somehow are forced to become musicians or to be part of a musical process. Of course, this Meyerhold quotation that you gave of being a conductor, I like it because it treats theater in a musical way. What I would oppose to is this conducting thing, because I would consider myself more of being a band leader, and also with this experience of what does it mean to make band music, especially when you're also songwriting. You come with a song, you have a very strong imagination of the song, but still, if you share the song with your other musicians, especially if you're in a band together where everyone knows each other well, always things are added and you never have the complete control, and the song goes through a process of being rehearsed by a band that will change the song. And I like this very much about the work in theater. I like this aspect of creating together and of really collectiveness of creating process. This also for me works through music and a lot with improvisation and a lot with also musical improvisation. But of course, in the end, I mean, it really depends on the text, but in the end, the text of course has a strong dominance and the meaning of the text. And at a certain point we ask ourselves the question, well, what does it all mean? And then this question is very strong in my work and I need answers for this. Sometimes you don't have the answer, then you can come back to music. But in a way, I wouldn't like to stop at a point where it's just a form and where it's art for art or art pour l'art, l'art pour l'art. And I think this maybe is a difference between me and some fine artists who also do theater, like maybe Bob Wilson and so on, but also two musicians who are doing theater, like Heiner Goebbels, or you mentioned Martala. Maybe they are a bit also in between meaning and non-meaning. I'm really in between and I'm thrown back from the one pole to the other. And maybe this movement somehow creates the artistic work in the end, also the production.
I would like to deepen this subject for a second, a little bit more, because I would like to know a little bit more about, you said that you strive for work in a collective sense or in a collective way, and you like to be more considered a band or band leader. And how does music really affect the working process? Does music have a democratizing effect? Could you say that? And what do you strive for? What do you think? What do you strive for in rehearsal if it's not to build up the perfect scene in the sense of transmitting the text and the sense of the text and to be true to the text in a traditional way? What do you strive for? What is the goal of this? Would be interesting for me to know.
As I like the tension between music and words, I also like the tension between written text and performing or performance. And these are really two very strong poles who are not the same. And they never fall together entirely in my work. And I think this is the difference, or something that makes my work different than many others, where many people are searching this, right? That the performance and the performing in the moment goes 100% together with the text, and you forget that it's written text. And you think, wow, this comes out of the mouth of the actor as if he thought it in this moment and so on. And I always keep up this difference because I like the tension between it. And very often in my productions, people come on stage with the script in their hands or with the book in their hands, and they read the text out of this script. And by reading this text out of the script, something happens to them. And we see what's happening to them, but we don't really see them being the script or them being the scripted character and so on. It's always a Verhältnis. It's always a relation between what's going on stage and what's written on paper or in the book. So I think it's about this. It's about creating the tension between these two poles and make it visible and make it possible to experience this tension and create some kind of musicality with this. And so often as a spectator, you are not given a result. So we don't say, okay, we've thought about this for 3 months now. We have an answer. We put this answer on stage and now please applaud or, do anything with it or learn your lesson, whatever is intended. But I like to invite the spectator to be part of a process. And so often, even if somehow our artistic process is finished by the premiere, the form tells a story of a process that is still going on. I like this idea of a production not being finished at the premiere and not ever being finished, not until the last performance, and still being in process. This has to do with that I like to invite the spectators of being part of something that is still in movement. And there are shows of mine that dealt with it a lot, like Kontrakte des Kaufmanns, which was a show that really wasn't finished, because in the final rehearsals, I noticed I cannot finish this play. It was a play by Elfriede Jelinek, written in 2008, right before the crash of Lehman Brothers Bank, and it dealt pretty much with this topic. It was about an Austrian scandal, financial scandal, where many politicians and important businessmen were involved. And so she somehow wrote the play about the crash that happened after she wrote the play. But we were doing it while all these things were so much in process. And I decided not to give an answer and not to have a finished solution, because there was none. Things were still going on, and each week someone killed himself or other institutions collapsed, and you couldn't really tell where is this crisis going to lead to. And so we created like a 4-hour happening. Maybe the first half hour was staged and the last half hour. And in between, we had about 3 hours of improvising, but with given structures, because during the rehearsal process, we found a lot of modules and a lot of games, if you want, that the actors could do with a certain bit of text. But each night, different actors had different bits of text. Nothing was fixed. And so each night really was different. And this only was possible because I left my director's seat and went on stage to the musician position. I was on stage, kind of a showmaster, leading through the show and explaining what this all is. And sometimes I also was performing some text, but most of the time I was directing while the show was taking place from on stage as a musician. So this really was an invitation into a process that was both very musical, very political, and it was very much appreciated by the people at that time, because there was not really a space like that where you had an open process in which it was possible to talk about all these things. Of course, there were newspapers and there were books written about it and so on, but they always had to have conclusions. And we could really be open and just ask questions or just create energies. What's going on with this crisis? What is this system? What is this neoliberal mantra that we're trapped in? How can we maybe deprogram everybody, you know, from this programmation that we had in the last 20 years and so on? That for me was maybe the production where it was the closest to what I'm looking for in theater, where everything came together, the openness of the process, the music, and the meaning.
Structurally, that is almost like a jam session. You know, you've got to, yes. You start mm-hmm. together, you know, okay, we're playing this theme together, we're playing All of Me or whatever. And then there's a period of pretty extended improvisations with a lot of freedom. And then at the end, you kind of find some kind of ending, but it's in no means the conclusive answer to that particular piece, or no one claims it's the ultimate rendition of that song or something. And even to the point of, I just wanted to add to your vivid description. I've seen it in Hamburg at the time, actually, and I still carry that memory. Also, not being able to decide when to visit the restroom, because you said, basically,
we're gonna play for 4 hours.
We were allowed to leave, but you didn't want to. So that was. but also, Jelinek kept writing texts. So not just your production wasn't finished, but also her writing wasn't finished, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. So she kept providing more pages. But what I just want to pick up on,
the amount of text that she wrote after the premiere was bigger than what she wrote before the premiere, and that already was like 5 hours if you just read it.
So she's not known for restriction, for restraining herself.
No.
but what I wanted to pick up on is that musicality is really happening on so many levels, in terms of it's not just an aesthetics for a performance or sort of something that you feel is present, you know, as music, musicians, instruments on stage, but it really is a structural aspect of rehearsing, a shift in kind of how do we approach theater. And you mentioned not seeing yourself as a conductor, but as a band leader. And I think that's a really important decision, that it's not so much about one person's single vision that asks 80 or 100 people to play to his baton, quite literally, but to enter into process where you suggest ideas, you bring in material, but the band song will always be a sort of an emergent thing, you know, that comes out of everyone's input, and it would never sound that way if you rehearsed it with other musicians and so forth, and it's really a sort of a collaborative process. I wanted to stay on that notion of the sound, I think, because I keep thinking about that term. We've talked about music, musicality, but I think it's also theater has a sound, and theaters, the buildings have a sound, and certain ensembles have a certain sound. And I'm not even quite sure what I mean by that, but I just feel that it's something, I feel that it's something that is important in your work, how to make the whole evening sound. And that includes voice, I think, but it also includes the use of music, but also how it's played back, how the instruments sound, when you use microphones, what do you do with them? So is that, how do you, beyond the question of what they say, what they play, sort of that idea of like a band would sort of have a sound, that it doesn't matter too much whether they play that chord or that chord, but it's coming through that instrument and those speakers and that technique. Is that something you think about consciously, or does that just come out sort of in a certain way, that the sort of Stehmann sound of theater, if you want to call it that?
I guess I'm pretty much focused on sound while working. I don't really do it consciously, but I know that I'm struggling a lot with sound, and as also, you know, the typical theater sound is very difficult for me, and it's very annoying, and I can't avoid it. I also have this, I mean, this way of loud talking, you know, if you talk without microphones, with this way of screaming when actors express anger and so on, it's often horrible, right? It's not beautiful, it's not a nice sound. And I guess maybe even in German theater it's worse than in other other theater cultures where people are a bit more tender and actors are a bit more, you know, they're more precise psychologically wise and not so, you know, German actors often are tanks or trucks and this gives them a great force also and a great courage. But often it sounds horrible and it's rude or it's and I suffer a lot from that, but still I can't avoid it in my work because I also look for a certain kind of intensity. And I think I can't, this is also a decision. I never decided to work against the medium and against the medium theater. And also this, I very much understand why people want to have control, why Bob Wilson or Andrea Breit. I very much understand it because you have to, you want to make things lighter or you want to make things more perfect and more beautiful and so on. And my experience as a viewer was that this always fails. I very much liked Bob Wilson's work when I was young and when I was a teenager somehow, when I was a student in high school and I had my first theater shows and there was Black Rider, the musical with Tom Waits in Thalia Theater in Hamburg. And this was one of my first conscious theater experiences as a becoming artist, if you want. I very much liked it, but I always noticed that this aiming for perfection never worked. There always was like a flying into the light bulbs or some mistakes happen. You always heard the sound of the stamping of the feet of the actors. And this was not staged, you know, there was no director who decided I want these sounds in a piece of art that, you know, had the Anspruch, had
was claiming or was aiming to,
claim. Was aiming for perfection.
Yeah.
And so there always was the imperfect, and that has to do with the medium. And I think especially my generation started to be very much aware of that because we grow up with so many other medium. And for us, making theater really was a decision, you know? Why do you make theater? This is, why don't you do rock music or why don't you do movies or why don't you do television or write books? This is all very good options at that time, and making theater was not so popular at that time. And I think I did it because of that, because of this possibility of failure at each moment and this life moment and how do you call it? This Eigenschaft, this
quality,
essence, you know, of this art form, that it can't be perfect, and you have to deal with it. And so I started especially in my first productions, I always started to stage the imperfect. I always staged mistakes and scenes where people didn't know, is it a mistake or is it staged or is it an accident or is it part of the show? And I always liked it when maybe half an hour later or so, you could understand, oh no, it was not the actor getting hurt, it was the character. But in that moment, it looked as if the actor was being hurt or if the production was being hurt and not the story or so. Yeah. I like to use that as a means of storytelling, as a means of theater, because for me it was so essential for the medium. Yeah. You know, trying to overcome the imperfection, that's what all theater directors somehow work on. And I also do that, especially, you know, if you're a musician, you need a certain perfection, or you need a certain structure of things. I don't like things if they are unstructured. But I'm not heading for a surface that has no holes in it. And it's like a balloon and shiny.
Absolutely. It reminds me a lot of a colleague of Dushka's, Ross Brown, who's also at Central. I think he's coined the term theater noise and the idea of the theater is a noisy medium. I mean, I get that you're talking about perfection, not just in a sonic way, but also in other respects. But even on that level, the idea that you can create a sort of, you know, and obviously theater buildings have been built that way as a soundproof box where nothing can come in. But as you say, then there's a light and it flickers when it goes down or cools down.
And there are theater buildings that don't work that way. For instance, if you go to Schauspielhaus Zürich, the theater that I run at the moment, it's very noisy. You hear all the streetcars and all the cars and all the helicopters flying over it. Yes. It wasn't initially made as a theater.
But it's precisely that embracing that and using that. I noted in the conversation with Thomas and Sebastian, your two musicians that you work with a lot, they told me this anecdote that they had built a little recording studio for themselves. It was all nice and pristine and good machinery, and it was lovely. And then they just went back to the kitchen and did it there because then you had a bird song and a car passing by, and it just got a bit sort of a bit noisy and a bit sort of not so pristine, not so perfect. And they and it added a certain mundanity and warmth and whatever. And they just liked that a lot better. And they said so far, none of their directors have complained about the noisy dirt.
It's very theatrical.
Yeah, exactly.
And this is,
yeah.
I mean, I think this is what I like about making theater. You don't have the control, the full control, and that also means you don't have the full responsibility for everything. I don't want to, you know, I want to do my best, you know, to guide the spectators in a certain way. And I like also being guided as a spectator. I like, you know, to somehow tell the spectator what to feel. Music helps a lot in doing so, but I don't want to have the complete responsibility for that. I also want to leave a rest of responsibility for coincidence, for instance, or for the uncontrollable, the unknown, the unforeseen, the life moment. And that goes, of course, very much as well for the artistic collaborants that I have. So there's always in each performance space for the actors to do the unforeseen and to do little, you know, things that surprise their partners, that surprise themselves. Nothing will be ruined when a cell phone goes on in a scene or so. And when I'm tending in the rehearsal process to be too focused on the perfection, I always think about this. What will we do if now a cell phone goes on? You know, will everything be destroyed, the whole illusion and so on? Or will we fall back to a point where we like to be, because we know on this level, the whole show takes place. It's where we are. You know, we don't completely lose ourselves in the show. We don't lose our neighbors that sitting next to us or used to sit next to us before Corona hit theaters. I don't know what will happen in the next season when no one's sitting next to us. And I think without this, one shouldn't really be doing theater. It's too much, but I would go crazy, you know, having this responsibility to get out all these things out of the stubborn media. It would be too much work for me. And also too much shouting and too much, you know, too much anger and too much tantrums and, you know, the things that you normally think directors are doing.
It appears like if you go for perfection, you go for something whole that is also closed. Mm-hmm. And that's the problem. Then if you want to integrate stuff that happens coincidentally, you cannot do it because you have created a whole thing, like a closed whole thing. Mm-hmm. And if you let it be open, then you can integrate these things without a problem. So that's a different approach. And when I talked to Thomas and Sebastian, they said something great about it. I think they said something like liveliness by failure, liveliness through failure. Mm-hmm. It connects to what you said before. And they also mentioned another word in German, zerfasern or verfransen.
Okay.
They said, we are the verfranser. And I think it might be good translated or well translated by maybe to fray out or fraying out something, the piece or the work or the performance through music and through sound and through their presence on stage. By being present on stage and not having a concrete role that they play and act out, they are somebody on stage that me as a spectator, I cannot really, I don't know who are they, what position do they have there, and they already make a difference on stage.
That's true. And whereas on the other hand, their music often holds things together, right? That's the opposite. Mm-hmm. Things that were verfranst, frayed out, whatever, before, because this goes for many levels, also the visual levels, like the semantic levels. I don't have control about my semantics. I don't know, with a lot of signs that are happening on stage, what do they mean? Where do they come from? Do they belong to each other? Do they have a consistency? No, they don't. You know, it's very heterogenic. Mm-hmm. And often it's the sound and the music that holds it together. But maybe it's true. Seeing the people creating the sound on stage again gives the sound something more materialist or less holy or so.
And on the other side, maybe to add on to that, the actors who are acting out roles or characters also, as you said before, are not perfect in their characters or are not fully in their characters. Yeah. They are somebody else. And I find it very fascinating. Who are they? They are some kind, they are also not the actor themselves. They are some kind of persona. What kind of persona are they? Fragmentary characters, but I don't know. The actors acting the role, something in between or so. There's also a tension.
When David mentioned earlier that when I stage classical texts, I want to make them like contemporary texts. I don't do it by modernizing them. Mm-hmm. Often I really leave the texts as they are. And this modern aspect comes from modern people who deal with this text or who create a relation between themselves and the text. And of course, I mean, this in the last couple of years became a very political topic as well, right? Who is talking, from which perspective, from which position, and so on. And this also, I think, changes and also in future will continue to change my work, because this somehow was a blind spot. I was talking from my position, from my perspective, assuming that it was the perspective of everybody somehow. And turning older, turning more established and being marked by a political discourse, which I debate, which I really welcome a lot and which I really support a lot, about privileges and about, you know, who has which position and who is allowed to make which observations, that also changes this thing. It changes the naivety of this perspective. Mm-hmm. So the question of who is talking will become much more diverse.
Mm-hmm. That completely resonates with something I found, that the discussion recently has been a lot about visibility and who's been seeing on stage and why are there not more people of color and why are there not more women, why are not there no disabled people, et cetera, et cetera. So the discussion about inclusivity has been on a visual level to a point. Mm-hmm. I'm not denying that at all. I'm saying that's a very important part of the discussion. But I think the audibility, as it were, sort of whose voice is being heard and how do these voices sound, and I think 10, 15 years ago, it would have been unthinkable in the Kammerspiele in Munich, and you've worked there, you know the theater and you know the city and sort of the kind of discourses they have about their theater, because it's their theater, to have people who don't have perfect diction, who have an accent, who, you know, don't have a trained voice and articulation of a drama school or something, to have that would have been impossible. And it raised quite a few eyebrows, and Lilienthal bringing that in and you bringing it in in your productions frequently. I'm thinking of someone like Jelena Kulic, who is a jazz singer with, I think, a Serbian background, if I'm not mistaken, brings, you know, a kind of voice, a kind of accent, a kind of presence on stage, which I always enjoyed a lot, but which is very unusual. And I think is great to have, and is a great addition to the kind of the sonic sphere on stage.
Munich was late. Münchner Kammerspiele were late, and I was really a bit shocked by these things raising discussions seriously. Yeah. I mean, it was like 5 years ago, 4 years ago that we did this, and it really raised discussions about, oh, they can't talk. And I've done that, I think, 20 years ago. I have had Sachiko Hara, for instance, in Wiener Burgtheater, and she was hardly understandable when she talked German. And that was great for texts that were difficult to understand, like Elfriede Jelinek. It was great to have a Japanese actress who just had arrived at that time in the German-speaking world and was really struggling with language, to see her struggle with such a complicated text. And in the end, it was sometimes much easier and better to understand her than to understand many trained German actors. And so Kammerspiele was way behind when they created debates about this, I think.
But still, I mean, early for Munich, I think. I wanted, with a view to the passing time, I wanted to pick up on two recent productions of yours, just so that we don't lose talking about them.
We should play some more sound.
Yes, precisely. We've lost track of that because it got too interesting. But we can do that now. So maybe first, can we talk a bit about a recent production you did in Zurich, based on a very, I mean, I wasn't aware of this novel before. I've recently heard about it. And I think in America, it's almost like the second Bible, you know, this book, Atlas Shrugged by Ayn Rand. And you decided it's a very much a sort of the Bible for the capitalist and the egotistical. You'll describe it better in a minute. But what I found very interesting is that you deliberately used the form or forms of the musical, as it were, because we've talked a lot about rock bands and a bit sort of that rebellious and rougher nature, and here you embraced a very different style.
Sie kennen
natürlich Objektivismus. Was mein Verstand als wahr erkennt, ist die Wahrheit ein Rent. Henk, können Sie auch schon in 9 Monaten liefern? Ist das überhaupt möglich?
Möglich. Miss Taggart, möglich ist alles für einen Mann mit Visionen. Aber ich werde Sie dafür bezahlen lassen.
Davon gehe ich aus, Henk. Wie viel?
$200 extra pro Tonne.
Das ist... Scheiße! Henk, ich...
Sie brauchen diesen Stahl, ich habe ihn niemand sonst.
Ich brauche diesen Stahl, Sie haben ihn niemand sonst.
Ich habe Sie also in der Hand.
Das haben Sie.
Ich habe Sie also in der
Sie
Hand.
Sie haben mich also in der Hand.
Sie würden auch das Doppelte bezahlen.
Ich würde auch das Doppelte bezahlen.
Sie würden auch das Doppelte bezahlen.
Ich würde auch das Doppelte, ja! Aber das würden Sie nicht verlangen.
Warum nicht? Kommen Sie mir nicht mit
Mitleid.
Ich komme
Ihnen nicht mit Mitleid.
Kommen Sie mir nicht mit
Mitleid. Ich komme Ihnen nicht mit Nein. Aber mit Egoismus.
Oh, das klingt interessant.
Ihr erstes Projekt mit Reed and Metall.
Tell us a bit about how you encountered this novel and how you made the decision to transform that in that particular way.
To make this novel, it had a bit to do with me starting as an artistic director here in Zurich, and Zurich being a city of money, and Switzerland being a country of money, and a country also of rich people, and thus a couple of debates about libertarianism, libertarian thinking. These things are somehow, they are a thing here, like in the United States, I think also like in the UK, that the state is something bad and that it's about private entrepreneurship that will create the good things in the world. And for this, it's important to be completely selfish and egotist and not having any social thoughts at all. Having social thoughts is evil. Being selfish is morally good. That's somehow the morality that, or the philosophy of Ayn Rand. And actually, this was the basis for the decision that we made upon this novel. It maybe was a bit naive because I underestimated a bit the evil energy of this novel, and also the level of writing and thinking and philosophy that is really very low. It's not really a good piece of art. And this is what offended me more than that it was a political point of view that wasn't mine. I wanted to do that. I wanted to confront myself with this political point of view. And I wanted to somehow reread this attempt of creating a moral philosophy for capitalism, and doing that in this country at that time. And I a bit underestimated how annoying it would be to deal with this kind of literature. It really was very, we suffered a lot. And this idea of turning it into a musical came very late. It came after I have started to rehearse. It was, I think, 5 or 6 weeks before the premiere that I noticed this will save our lives. This will somehow save our asses in dealing with this thing, because you can't just, you know, create a show based on a piece of literature, or I can't do that, based on a piece of literature only to criticize this piece of literature.
To expose how bad the literature.
There has to be some value in it, and I have to construct something before I can deconstruct it. And this with normal theater means, and the normal theater means that I have, was not possible. And then I noticed it can be good, or it would be a beautiful idea to have a Broadway musical or an off-Broadway musical based on this novel. And something like this doesn't exist. Actually, I don't know why. I think some American musical producer should do that, because, and maybe they don't, because it's so somehow poisoned in the United States. You know, no liberal left-wing person will ever touch this novel because they know there are loads of people who take it serious and who live by that novel and who don't do good to the world. Yeah. and who are really the enemies. But here somehow we could use it, you know, as a thing to play with and to give it a reread through this perspective. And when I had the idea this would be a great subject for a musical, I could start to create and to create something. And so I created a propaganda musical for capitalism in the sense of Ayn Rand. And having this means of musical allowed me to have a second layer that was like satiric or ironic without being shallow or without being cheesy or cheap or too clever. Because many musicals who were very successful in the last time were very satirical, like the Book of Mormon or like Urinetown. It was a big off-Broadway hit. Spamalot. So you know, the musical genre is used to being ridiculed from inside or from within. That helped me a lot to create this novel and criticize it in the same way, and to being both serious and non-serious in the same moment, to create feelings for, you know, characters that we don't really like, and at the same time show that the feelings that we create at the moment are not one-to-one or meant to tell something else. And there we were very close to something maybe like Three Penny Opera or Brecht Weill terms of theater, where it always was about, you know, sending a message, but also to create a genre first, or create, serve the genre, if you want.
We could talk about this a lot longer, but we're heading towards the end, and I think we're running out of time, like Hamilton and Hamilton. Because we're in the middle of this pandemic, and you've responded to this pandemic, as many theatres have in different ways. Some just dug out their old recordings and streamed them. You've created something which you called the Corona Passion Plays, or Passionsspiele, as it were. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to reflect on that, because again, for the online format, so this is genuinely created during lockdown under these conditions for an online audience. Mm-hmm. And again, you chose a musical sort of vehicle or the format of songs at a song cycle, essentially, to do that. Other people have done very different, although actually Christopher Rüpping also did in Zurich, did a wonderful series of online performances that were created for that medium rather than for the theater and then filmed. Do you want to talk about that and how you felt that, again, through writing and music and songs, you could almost keep the theater going better than through theater in a conventional sense?
Yeah, I mean, it really came out of the situation. It started with the thought or the feeling that these days need theater, and that all the things that are going on, also the things that we don't talk about during these times of lockdown, because we're so dealing with ourselves and what is going on with our kids and the homeschooling and the home office and so on. I thought this time would need theater. And this brought me back to the classical Passionsspiele, which is, a Central European, often in German-based thing. And in Germany, that came of the late medieval time, often dealing with plagues or with diseases, where people were starting to make the Passionsspiele of the Passion of Jesus. And so they made the vow, once this is over, we'll do the best theater plays ever. And being in lockdown, where there was no theater, the theater was closed and we were not supposed to go out and to see each other and to rehearse with each other, and to really know theater is touching and theater is contact and theater is being close together and theater is bodies in the same space. So all these things that we're not supposed to do, I could understand why the thought of we have to do theater comes out of a time like this. In the beginning, that was just this title, Corona Passionsspiele. And it was really annoying to be artistic director of a theater in this time, because it was so much work. It's so much more work to run a theater that is not playing than to run a theater who actually is playing. I wouldn't have thought this before. And to escape that a little, I started with this artistic project, and this was a big relief. Artistically, it was fine to be without theater for a while, because I could turn back to music. and I could turn back to songwriting. And I put out all my instruments again and my recording devices, and I did in home recording and home office. I created these songs, and then these songs went out to a befriended video artist and to actors of our ensemble, and they did something with the songs, and we made video clips of this and put them online. And in the end, I mean, we were very lucky because Switzerland is quite liberal at the moment, or in the last couple of weeks. I mean, at the moment now the numbers are going up again, so I wonder whether this was too early or not. But they were, in the last couple of weeks, allowing theaters to play again with certain restrictions. And so we were able to create a theater piece out of these songs. So we have done this on stage already. We have this huge hall where normally I think maybe 600, 700, 800 people can fit in, depending on how you seat them. And we had this for 100 people. So we had a lot of distance between the spectators, and we created little islands like living rooms in this huge hall and held a concert. But also there was text involved. There were texts of Elfriede Jelinek. She wrote a play during this lockdown, so she already somehow has reacted on Corona. And I wrote a column for the newspaper, for the NZZ in Zurich, so we also had some text that could be said. And so in the end, I mean, we didn't really have a lot of time to rehearse, and we rehearsed under the restrictions, the safety restrictions with Corona, so no touching, no screaming in your face. And if you sing, you know, sing in front of you, and there's, I think, 6 meters, nobody else has to be there, and so on. So it wasn't really a strong and intense rehearsing process, and we just had like less than 2 weeks. This thing was not planned. This thing was with no budget and just using the means that the theater has. And this was such a great experience, actually, to being spontaneously in an institution like this. And even though I lead this institution, I struggle a lot with the institution's will for planning and for planning long term ahead and being not really flexible. And I'm looking for flexibility in my work, and I'm looking for openness and for, you know, the unknown to happen. This institution doesn't. This institution wants to know everything 3 years in advance. And so it was very good, you know, to somehow use this special time to do a special production. And actually, you know, we were talking about what happened. In the end, it was 14 songs coming out, and we related these songs to the 14 weeks since the lockdown. Between the lockdown and the show, there were 14 weeks, and each week like had a show. And so we really had a chronicle of what had happened. And The last like word of this chronicle was a quotation by an activist of Black Lives Matters. That we just had a sound file. I didn't make a song for that because I thought I can't make satirical songs about Black Lives Matter movement at this time. It would strongly be misunderstood. But I wanted to support it. And since it was part of this time of lockdown, I wanted to have it involved in the show. And so this was the last word. And I wonder if we can repeat it. We'll decide after summer whether this is now dated, or maybe it's good, like a good document of this time, because it really, with all means, with the form, with what the songs are talking about, even with my whole family was involved because it was a lockdown project. My daughter is singing in it, my wife is singing in it, so it was a bit like, you know, the videos that you could see from people in the living rooms, you know, singing with their families. This was also visible in the show, so I pretty much like what came out of it. But it started with me being somehow also, yeah, if there's no theater, because you always say, oh, if there's no theater we all die. I think so. I think maybe that goes for a society and a city. I think we really need theater, and I also can give reasons for this. Me personally, as an artist, I also can do some time without theater. It's also a good thing to know.
But you seemed like music has helped you through this process.
Yeah, definitely.
Through the late process.
Yes, definitely.
And
definitely.
Makes me think about, did your relationship to music change? Or let me say, music in theater or music for theater, did it change over the course of your work life so far? Or were there essential changes in your relationship? Or is it still very central, the same as in the beginning? Or
Oh, how many minutes do I have for the answer? I try to make it quick. No, it's so many. I think it's constantly changing. In the beginning, I almost started to avoid, and not really music, but to avoid myself as a musician being part of my shows. I had other musicians, I lent the composition over to them, and I took myself back. I didn't want to intervene, you know, I didn't want to dominate them. And as I don't want to do it with actors, I don't tell actors how to act. I'm an acting teacher. So I give them a frame in which they can act, and I wanted to give a frame in which music could happen. So it took some time until me coming back as a musician, on stage. The step on stage was a step as a musician on stage. And then I noticed, no, it's not vanity or so. I was afraid of, you know, being vain and spoiling and or damaging my work. I thought, no, it's not vanity. It's really an essence of my work that I'm also part of it, that I can be on stage, as a musician. It helps the work. And this experience brought me back in as a musician much more. And at the moment, I'm doing this experience of writing, because I've written a play now in the last season. I've written this musical. It's maybe 10, 20% of Ayn Rand, or 10%. The dialogues, the songs, also the storyline is pretty new, you know, based on the fable, or on the thoughts of Ayn Rand, and on the basic story of Ayn Rand. But I invented quite a lot. And so this is something I discover at the moment, and discovering me again as a songwriter. That's the step that I was at now during this time of lockdown. Now, when it gets back to work, should it go back to work really in the rehearsal space? The question would be, how does this relate with actors, for instance? If I really go back in a rehearsal process and a working process with actors, you know, they can't just sing my songs. They are not, it's not really enough. Then it's better if I sing my songs. And so what will happen when the actors come with their needs, with their skills, with their specifications? So how will this affect the work again? So it's a constant shift and change. It always centers around music, always.
We can, I think, as an outro, then listen to a track from Corona, Passion Plays.
Scheibe gibt mir Schuss,
Plexiglas, Plexiglas,
portieren Viren Umweltschmutz,
Plexiglas, Plexiglas,
nichts kommt rein und nichts kommt raus,
Plexiglas, Plexiglas,
das sieht richtig super aus. Mehr Kraft,
Plexiglas, Plexiglas,
stopp manchen bösen Saft,
Plexiglas, Plexiglas,
die Scheibe ist ein Hit,
Plexiglas, Plexiglas,
und alle machen mit.
Thank you very much, Nicholas, for sharing your thoughts and your ideas around theater, music, and sound, and orality. And thank you, Katharina, for sharing yours and for asking very good questions as well. And that's
thank
fantastic.
You
okay,
thank you, David. Thank you, Katharina.
You're very welcome.
Bye.
Bye, Nicholas. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to Lend Me Your Ears, presented by Duška Radosavljević, curated by Flora Petrolo, and produced by Tim Dano. The Lend Me Your Ears podcast is part of Oral Dramaturgies, an AHRC leadership fellowship held by Duška Radosavljević at the Royal Central School of Speech and Drama.